Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, June 2nd, 2003. In the fireside room this morning, John Lauber is presenting a session entitled Historic Preservation at Holden, Stewardship of the Built Environment, Little Old Ladies in Tennis Shoes, The Evolution of Preservation. This is session LAJ 2003-01. Let's listen in.
Welcome to the first session of this elder hostel. I apologize for having to stand back at the back of the room, but my remote control for my slides is back here, so I guess I need to be back here too. So if you can't hear me, yell at me or poke me. I wanted to explain a little bit about what my sessions for the week will have to do with. I think Don's going to talk a lot about the history of the mine and the history, the geology of this area. So he's maybe more of a pure historian of this place than I'm going to be. But I wanted to talk about an aspect of environmentalism that often is not recognized by many of us, and that is historic preservation as stewardship of the built environment. At Holden, you go into the bathroom and you see the signs telling you, giving you instructions on how to use the toilet and instructions on how to deal with your towels and your waste from lunch. And I think we're all very conscious of environmentalism here in terms of living in a wilderness area and making good use of resources. But Holden is another type of resource. It's a cultural resource. This is a term that's used in my field to talk about historic places. So it's a wilderness place, but it's also a historic place, and as such is a cultural resource. And there is an active movement in this country to protect and preserve pieces of the built environment, just as there are active movements to protect pieces of the natural environment. So that's kind of the general theme for what I'm going to talk about this week. And I'm going to go through a progression that will get us closer and closer to Holden Village. But I thought it would be useful to start by looking back over the last couple hundred years in the U.S., and not in James Michener fashion. I won't get quite that detailed. But just give you an overview of kind of how we got to where we are today and who some of the players have been over the years. So the title of day one's presentation, as you can see, is Little Old Ladies in Tennis Shoes. And the reason I pulled that out is because women, especially in the early years of historic preservation, played a very pivotal role in this country. They were kind of the first people to notice those cultural resources and to stir people up to protect them. These women happen to be the DAR ladies who are standing near the Henry Sibley House across from Fort Snelling in on the confluence of the Minnesota and Mississippi Rivers in the Twin Cities of Minnesota. This photo was taken in 1910. And they are proudly standing in front of the Henry Sibley House, as I said, which was the home of the first territorial government for the Minnesota Territory. They had just acquired this house, which had been in ruins, and were about to embark on a very active preservation program for that place. So those are some of the little old ladies in tennis shoes that started preservation in Minnesota. You're going to see a lot of Minnesota here, and I apologize for that, but that's my territory, so you're going to have to deal with it. Probably the first documented preservation activity in the United States happened here, Philadelphia, Independence Hall. A few years after the turn of the 1800s, this place had fallen into disrepair. The city wasn't interested in maintaining it. There was some thought given to preserving it by having the city purchase the building and maintain it. Nobody was interested in doing that. So a local group of people started to stir up empathy for this place, and eventually prevailed and basically talked the city into buying this building, which we, how many of you have been here? Independence Hall. It's, I mean, to most of us, that's sort of an iconic American place, and yet it was very close to not being there. That was a local effort. On the national level, this is Mount Vernon as it looked in 1853, the home of George Washington. It was still, at this time, owned by the Washington family, who had kind of fallen on hard times, as you can see. There's a nice bend in the roof of the veranda there, and it's a few props holding things up. There was a group of people around that area who felt that the federal government should become involved and purchase this place and turn it into a museum commemorating the first president. Well, there wasn't much interest at the federal level in doing that. So a woman named Ann Pamela Cunningham, who's the fourth from the left there, one of those little old ladies in tennis shoes, took it upon herself to start something. And what she started was a state-by-state effort to raise consciousness of the condition of Mount Vernon. She got Edward Everett, who was a famed orator of the time, to go to all of the states, which at that time were part of the U.S., on a fundraising lecture circuit, and they raised $70,000, which was enough to purchase Mount Vernon and to begin what has been a 150-year-long restoration project. This is what it looks like today. It's a little bit blurry, I apologize. This is a project that is still administered by the Mount Vernon Ladies Association. It is not a government entity of any sort. It's still those little old ladies in all 50 states raising the money, doing the work, hiring the interpreters, and taking care of the property. So we, you know, how many of you have been to Mount Vernon? I bet more hands go up. You wouldn't have been there.
One interesting point, I was there a few years ago and they were repairing the roof with mm-hmm. cypress shingles mm-hmm. and they had gotten logs that had been underwater for several hundred years to
so even the shingles were from the right period of time. Yeah.
But it looks like the architecture's changed.
I think this is a different view.
Is this the back side? Because there's a veranda there.
The one that
Yeah, doesn't look
back.
Anything like it.
Looks back.
Yeah, I think we're looking at the other end. But thank you for pointing that out because I was so focused on getting my slides that I didn't even pay attention to that.
Cypress shingles?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's interesting. I'm so used to cedar shingles.
Sort of the next milestone is this. Yellowstone National Park was established in 1872 as the world's first national park. The idea was to protect not a historic area, but a natural area that is, as we all know, is a very interesting natural area. Another interesting thing about this, however, is that in 1872, the three states that comprise Yellowstone National Park weren't states yet. This was federal land, part of the Great Westward Purchase from Louisiana Purchase. So it was government land, but there were no state governments to administer it, so the Department of the Interior sort of inherited this place. And to most of us today, the Department of Interior equals the National Park Service. Well, this is kind of where it all began. There was no place to put this park, so the Department of Interior just got it. But it represents a real milestone in preservation because it's the first time that a whole parcel was taken out of circulation and turned into a preserve of some sort. Ricky?
I was in D.C. and they had an art exhibit. I can't remember the name of the artist, but he went into Yellowstone and came back to the East Coast with these incredible paintings.
I think it's Thomas Moran.
Is that who it is?
Yeah.
And that, yeah, so you already know that.
Yeah, I think we'll see one of his paintings in another day.
But that's kind of what got people...
Yeah, I mean, behind this establishment of the park was a whole long period of time of people advocating, raising consciousness, because most people had never been there. And most of the, you know, Congress was from out east, so it really took some behind-the-scenes work to make this happen. But there's Yellowstone National Park. We're 131 years into it. And
this location had a particular problem, and that is Old Faithful. And it was a problem because it was so incredible. The descriptions, you lost credibility with
the
listeners.
Nobody believes
it. Nobody.
I know that one of the descriptions of Yellowstone is where hail boiled over, I think. This is another preservation milestone. In the 1870s, there was a growing amount of exploration in the Southwest, especially looking at prehistoric cliff dwellings and ruins of prehistoric cultures. A lot of it done by a guy named Henry Morgan, who was an archaeologist, an early archaeologist, who came back with tales of these fabulous ruins of cliff houses and entire cities sort of carved out of the earth. And he felt that, in particular, this place, Casa Grande, which is a huge ruin, you can see a person standing there in front of it, A, was in bad shape, and B, needed to be stabilized and preserved and protected in some way. And so he was from the East Coast, and he went back and sort of rounded up a lot of his New England friends who went to Congress in 1889 and asked for this place to be set aside as a preserve, and noted that it needed to be protected, stabilized physically, that there was some deterioration going on that really needed to be stopped. Well, Congress kind of fiddled with it for a while, and in 1889, surprisingly, they earmarked $2,000 to stabilize the ruin, but didn't put it into public ownership or public protection. But with that $2,000, they built a roof, which is not this roof, over the ruin, and restored some of the foundations and so forth. And then 3 years later, after a lot more lobbying, it was eventually set aside as a federal preserve.
Where is it?
Arizona, thank you. Another thing that happened after the Civil War was that a lot of veterans groups were very interested in protecting battlegrounds where they had fought during the Civil War. The government thought that was a good idea, the federal government, Congress. But the mechanism they used was to condemn those battlefields and to take them into public ownership. Well, in 1896, one of the owners of the Gettysburg battlefield objected to that use of the police power, to the condemnation proceedings, and eventually this case went to court, eventually it went to the Supreme Court, and in 1896 the Supreme Court made a decision that held that preservation of historic places was indeed a public benefit and therefore was an appropriate use of the condemnation proceedings. So that was a landmark court case that started to build a legal infrastructure for historic preservation. We've heard a lot in the last few months in the aftermath of the beginning of hostilities in Iraq about the pillaging of antiquities, which tends to be archaeological sites. Well, a lot of this was happening in the United States at the end of the 19th century as well, and eventually that attracted the attention of people in Washington. And in 1906, they passed a federal law, the Antiquities Act, which is kind of the first formal historic preservation law in the U.S. I'm going to read through my papers here so I can get the language right.
So what is that?
This is Devil's Tower, National Monument in North Dakota, Montana, Wyoming. Out there somewhere. Where is it?
Yeah, it's up in northeastern Wyoming.
Wyoming, yeah.
So it's a rock formation?
It's a natural rock formation. The Antiquities Act protected objects of historical or scientific interest. That was the terminology. This would obviously be scientific interest. But it was a presidential decree that was required. This was a flap that happened at the end of the Clinton administration with Mount Shasta, I believe, and some other places. The president could designate these places and take them into federal ownership as national monuments, but it was historic or scientific places. Well, I mentioned earlier that Yellowstone was established in 1872 before there was an administrative body to take care of it. So the Department of Interior was the default administrator of the first national park. But by 1916, there were quite a few more national parks, somewhere in the mid-teens. And the administration of these places was becoming quite a problem. So one solution was to have the U.S. Army step in and be the administrators of these parks. And if you've been to Yellowstone to Mammoth, you're essentially in a remnant of an army camp. It was created early on to help sort of ride herd on people who wanted to use Yellowstone National Park. And in fact, if you think of the National Park Service uniforms and think back to the early part of the 1900s, that uniform is in fact a version of the U.S. Cavalry uniform from the early 1900s, the campaign hat, the puttees and so forth. But that's kind of where that uniform came from. Well, by 1916, there were enough of these parks that the Congress felt there needed to be a more explicit administrative body for those parks. And so they created the National Park Service as a subdivision of the Department of the Interior, and in the Organic Act for that institution, it mandated that the Park Service was to conserve the scenery and natural and historic objects and wildlife in those parks and to provide for the enjoyment of those places by any means appropriate. So there again, in the establishment of the National Park Service, the precedent was set for protecting those historic places. This happens to be Mesa Verde National Park, another cliff dwelling in Colorado. And this was taken in 1925. These are some of the park superintendents gathered for an early conference.
There's a couple of women there.
And I don't know who they are, but this ties nicely
into what. So the women did that too. Yep.
Let me jump ahead about 10 years to the mid-20s, and John D. Rockefeller, who as we all know was a pretty well-off sort of guy, who had a friend who was the rector of the Bruton Parish Church in Williamsburg, which had been the colonial capital of Virginia. In the late 1920s, Williamsburg looked like this, a pretty ordinary small town from that period of time. Well, the rector of this church felt that Williamsburg had a better history than that, I guess, and that it ought to be restored to its original glory as a colonial capital and commemorated in that way. And Rockefeller bought the idea, literally. And so beginning in the late 20s, this is that same street today. How many of you have been to Williamsburg? With great financial help from John D. Rockefeller, Williamsburg was dismantled and reconstructed as an interpreted historic site. One of the really interesting things about it, or one of the new things about it, was that it was a research-based reconstruction. And I'm going to show you one example that's quite well known. This is the Governor's Palace, which in 1926 wasn't there. What was there was stuff under the ground. the archaeological ruins, so there was an excavation done that helped give some form to that missing building. But there weren't any pictures. There was very little evidence as to what the superstructure of the building looked like until somebody was doing research at Oxford and came upon this illustration of the governor's palace at Williamsburg, and that was used to help reconstruct the building. We'll hop back and forth here a little bit. But that marked another milestone in the history of preservation in that it squarely put the burden on research as a way out. You didn't just make something that looked historic, you had to have a basis for it. In the early 30s, another thing happened in a couple of places that was very interesting. In Charleston, South Carolina, there were residential neighborhoods that by uniform agreement were considered to be historic and intact. And so without any enabling legislation allowing them to do this, the city of Charleston established the nation's first historic district and instituted a system of design review. So if you wanted to do something to one of these buildings, you had to appear before a board of architecture, describe what you wanted to do, work with them, and if your plans were approved, you received a certificate of appropriateness. There was absolutely no legal precedent or legal basis for this whatsoever, but the community felt that these places were so important that it was never really much of a problem. It was by consensus that this was allowed to happen. A few years later, New Orleans followed suit. There were other places in the country that did as well. In the case of New Orleans, the state legislature actually passed the historic district legislation, making the Vieux Carré Historic District, the French Quarter, a protected historic district. The 30s were rough times, as we all know, and we've all heard about the WPA and some of the federal make work programs. Historic preservation also benefited from some of those programs. We'll talk about some WPA work in just a minute, but one thing that happened in the early 30s was a program designed for unemployed architects and engineers called the Historic American Buildings Survey, and you can see an example of their work on in the illustration here. It was an attempt to go throughout the country and identify and document places that had national importance, because many of them had fallen into grave states of disrepair. And there was great fear that a lot of these places would just disappear, and so that what would be left after the Historic American Buildings Survey folks did their work was a very complete record of what had been there, with notes. These drawings were drawn to show every flaw and bend, but they just documented what was there. These are housed at the Library of Congress. This is a program that has been going since 1933. Was greatly expanded in the 60s, but many, many of these places have disappeared in fact, but there is a record of them at the Library of Congress, so that was a preservation effort. Another piece of legislation that happened in the 30s was the Historic Sites Act of 1935. Again, the national park system was growing by leaps and bounds, including a number of historic parks. And so Congress authorized a Historic Sites Act, which mandated the Department of Interior to do a survey, a nationwide survey, to identify places of national importance with the idea that they might eventually become part of the national park system. And we'll look at one. These are kind of blurry photos, I apologize. We looked at Williamsburg a minute ago, which was kind of the center of a three-part three sites that are very close together that many people felt exemplified or embodied much of the colonial period. It would be Jamestown, the first settlement site, Williamsburg, the colonial capital site, and Yorktown, where the British surrendered at the end of the Revolutionary War. Well, during the 30s, the Park Service took this these three sites and linked them with a constructed, carefully thought out parkway, the Colonial Parkway, a constructed landscape, and turned that into Colonial Historical Park. So now if you go to Williamsburg, you can take your car and drive to Jamestown and drive to Yorktown, and you're not constantly surrounded by McDonald's and gas stations and so on and so forth. So that was a WPA project that was done with historic preservation specifically in mind.
Did they use the CCCs in there?
I don't know if the CCC worked on this project. It could very well have, but I'm not sure. But they did do a lot of historic restorations other places. Another program that was ongoing that many of us don't think of as historic preservation is just the marker programs. They sort of hit the fore in the 30s as highway construction took off. Many state highway departments put up those waysides where you could pull off the road and read about local history, some site that had disappeared eons ago. But marker programs went back for years and years and years, and possibly would, I think it would be fair to say they in a way are maybe the first preservation effort, where something happened here, you put up a marker, commemorated that site, whether you've preserved it or not. This is the Coit Tower in San Francisco. This is a plaque that was put up in the late 30s by the DAR, so those little old ladies were busy in San Francisco too. And it commemorates the site of the first telegraph station.
This is Telegraph Hill?
Yep. Uh-huh. As you might imagine, preservation activity died out pretty much during World War II, as did many things. But after the war, it came back with a vengeance. there was a growing awareness as the nation rebuilt. People returned from the war. There was a lot of housing being put up. Highway construction was getting started. All these things that had happened in the 30s and before that had kindled some interest in historic preservation. And there was some sense that there needed to be an umbrella organization in the country to sort of deal with that issue other than the Park Service. And so in 1949, the National Trust for Historic Preservation was established as a quasi-federal government. They received some funding from the federal government, but were a freestanding nonprofit organization charged with a couple of things. One is sort of inheriting troubled historic sites. This is Woodlawn Plantation in Northern Virginia. It was the first site that the trust acquired. I think now they have about 19 all over the country. There had been a local group that had tried to take this project on, administer the site, was having financial difficulty. The trust stepped in and has been administering this site ever since. And another role for the trust was advocacy and education. And I don't know if any of you are trust members, but they publish a fine magazine. They have a lot of programs to help state organizations foster historic preservation. So it's a going concern, continually expanding its purview. In the 1960s, another program that was hatched by the Historic Sites Act took a little bit of a turn. I talked about the Historic Sites Act of 1935 ordering the Department of Interior to sort of catalog historic sites with the idea that the Park Service eventually would acquire those sites. Well, by the 1960s, that catalog had been completed, and there were an awful lot of places on that list. And so Congress wrote a small change into the nature of the Historic Sites Act, allowing the federal government to designate historic sites of national significance, even if it did not own those sites. So with owner permission, the feds could say, this is a place where something important to the nation's history happened. We're going to put a plaque on it, a marker program again. We're going to commemorate it, but you own it. The first one of these was the Sergeant Floyd Monument in Sioux City, Iowa. It was the site of the grave site of a soldier on the Lewis and Clark expedition. He was the only person to die on that expedition, and I think is at that time there was some hay made with the fact that he was the first white person to die west of the Mississippi or something like that. So, not a very impressive historic site, but the designation idea was a new idea that the government could give you a prize for having a historic site without taking ownership of it.
Could you charge admission for people to see it?
I don't know if the rules allow that or not. So we're basically at 1960 now, and I put this up just to show what much of the American attitude toward historic preservation has been, and in some ways continues to be. This is a country where we're on the move all the time. Progress is good, stasis is bad. By the 1960s, you know, we'd come out of the war, the economy was good. The way you did stuff here was get rid of the old and come back with something new. So how to turn a Hilton into a hotel? Well, you tear down the old one and you build a new one. This is 1960.
They did the same thing in Seattle. They had a triangular lot, and it was a Seattle hotel in our Pioneer Square district. And we have now what's called the Sinking Ship Garage there. Mm-hmm. It looks like. And that started the historic Pioneer Square.
Okay.
Preservation in Seattle.
Well, so it did some good after.
Lost that important building.
By the 60s, a couple of other things had really reached full fruition following World War II. The first was the construction of the interstate highway system. Mm-hmm. And you get an idea here of how any of us have driven on these through a city know what they do. They basically created new rivers through cities, and the way they did that was to take out entire neighborhoods that had existed in the interest of traffic efficiency. And in that process, a lot of old stuff was lost, but also a lot of historic stuff was lost. There were a lot of valuable places that disappeared as part of highway construction. And the other is urban renewal. So that's why the slide earlier said the federal bulldozer. These were federal programs that went in and cleaned up entire portions, generally of cities, with great loss of many historic properties. Well, by the mid-60s, that tear-it-down mentality was starting to change. This is an Ed Koren cartoon from the New Yorker that gives you a little glimmer. But the mid-60s was the LBJ era, the Great Society era, when all kinds of cultural programs were sort of being well-funded. We were a very progressive society in many ways. In 1965, there was a meeting of the U.S. Conference of Mayors in Washington. They got together and commissioned a study of what had been lost through some of these construction programs. And what came out was a book with Heritage So Rich, published by the National Trust in 1966, that documented some of the losses and called for creation of a federal infrastructure that would basically protect historic places from the federal government. And so a year later, this came to pass in the form of the National Historic Preservation Act of 1966. That's kind of the real turning point. It's the basis for all historic preservation activity these days. It was a sweeping law that did a number of things, and you can see the list here, but there had been this survey started in the mid-30s to identify historic places. Well, the Historic Preservation Act of 1966 created a National Register of Historic Places, which allowed for places to be designated, not acquired, by the federal government. It allowed for all kinds of places to be designated as historic, places that were not only nationally significant, but significant to states or local places as well. And it established a system of protections for those properties, primarily directed towards federal agencies, so that if there is a federal highway program happening someplace, those historic places have to be considered as part of the planning. There was a Supreme Court created to arbitrate disputes between federal agencies and the historic, the owners of the historic places. That's called the Advisory Council for Historic Preservation, and it's just an arbitration board. And then there was a decentralized system of state historic preservation offices created to administer these programs at a state level, with some understanding that knowledge of historic places in a state is most likely to be lodged in that state and not in Washington, D.C. For the last 7 years, I have worked for the Minnesota State Historic Preservation Office. And in 30 days, that job will come to an end due to our state budget crisis, so I'm on the streets. One little tweak happened in 1971. You recognize this guy. Richard Nixon signed, President Nixon signed an executive order that gave protection to places that had been deemed eligible for the National Register but not placed on the National Register. Mm-hmm. So what that meant was that even if an owner said, I don't want my place on the list, if it was evaluated and determined that it met the criteria for the National Register, it was protected from the federal government. So this was something that actually worked in favor of the property owner. Also in the 60s, we started to see a rethinking of how to go about historic preservation, on often on economic terms. It's the beginning of the boutiquing of historic preservation, I suppose we could say. There was a city planner named James Rouse from Boston. Somebody came to him and said, we need a public market here, a gathering place for people. And it occurred to him that a historic place, the Fon, I'm going to say this wrong, Fonville Hall and Quincy Market were a deteriorated historic marketplace, that he made the connection. We can have a new market in the old market, and so this is an adaptive reuse of a historic place, carried out with great assistance from the city of Boston. And it stands as one of the first really successful historic adaptive reuses in historic preservation. Another economic turn was taken in the 70s with the first Tax Reform Act of 1976. It was rewritten again 10 years later, but it provided substantial tax credits for the rehabilitation of historic buildings that were used for commercial purposes. This is the Milwaukee Road Depot in Minneapolis. In its heyday in the early part of the 19th century, that building stood vacant for 25 years and has recently been reopened as a hotel complex. That train shed off to the right has been enclosed in glass and is now an indoor skating rink, ice skating rink. But it sat for 25 years, and with the help of those tax credits, they were able to rehab that building, and it's now back on the tax rolls and serving a useful purpose. Another landmark decision, court case, took place in 1978. New York City was one of the first communities, was an early community to have a state or a local historic preservation ordinance. The Penn Central Railroad wanted to sell air rights, the unused space above Grand Central Station, to a developer who wanted to build a skyscraper in that area. And as you know, in downtown New York, there's not much ground space, so airspace is very valuable, economically valuable. Well, Penn Central said that by denying the railroad the ability to sell those air rights, the city of New York was unfairly taking their property. This went all the way to the state or to the federal Supreme Court, which held that historic preservation, again, was a suitable public purpose, and that Penn Central didn't have a leg to stand on, essentially. So it upheld the local preservation ordinance. Just to give you some sense of who's involved in historic preservation, I am, obviously, so I'm that sort of person, I guess. We've talked about some of them. At the national level, we have the National Park Service as sort of an overseer. Every federal agency is responsible for monitoring its own activities, identifying historic places, and trying to make sure that its activities don't adversely affect those places. We've talked about the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation as sort of the Supreme Court to arbitrate disputes between agencies and historic places. And then the National Trust, which is a quasi-federal advocacy group. So that's at the national level. The state level, we have the network of state historic preservation offices that administer the National Register program for each state, distribute some federal grant monies to local governments. There are state agencies that are often responsible under state law to the preservation office, much in the same way that federal agencies are responsible to the advisory council. And then there are statewide advocacy groups, and that's everything from a county historical society or a local museum to many states have a statewide historic preservation group that is actually a lobbying organization and does educational programs and so forth. At the local level, many local units of government have instilled preservation ordinances to control historic districts in their community, generally in the form of a Heritage Preservation Commission that's charged with that specific responsibility. And then there are local advocacy groups that, as I said, the local museums and so forth that often will take on a project, restore a house museum, do historic preservation at the grassroots level. One of the things that's happened in the last 15 years or so is that preservation has really expanded from a small picture of a particular historic building or a very small place to take a broader view and start looking at entire communities, preserving a way of life, the built environment being a component of that, but really looking at the interaction of economics, public realm design, keeping people at home in small towns, those sorts of things. This is an example of a Main Street that's quite famous. This is Main Street Sauk Center, Minnesota, as it appeared in 1949, when Life magazine described it as the prototype for the American Main Street, because it was the prototype for Gopher Prairie, Minnesota, in Sinclair Lewis's book, Main Street. That's what it looked like in 49. That's what it looks like today, with the exception of Ben Franklin. It's not in bad shape. Many communities have seen downtown revitalization as an economic tool that they can use to keep their small communities viable and to keep people they like there. This is another offshoot of the World War II, the return of GIs, the need for rapid construction of housing, the suburbanization of America. The National Trust in particular has been very active in the last few years in anti-sprawl legislation and awareness building. There have also been sort of non-beat you over the head with a stick activities carried out by designers, the new urbanists, who see value in traditional town planning, where there's a downtown with apartments above stores, and there's stores at the street level, and you can walk every place. That has become part of the historic preservation movement these days. This is a neighborhood that is a historic district in Minneapolis. It's the Nokomis Knoll Historic District. It's a pretty nondescript, late 30s, a residential neighborhood, but the people in that community felt that there was value in the uniformity of the houses, the scale of things, being able to walk places, and so this was through the efforts of the local community added to the National Register about 2 years ago. It is a historic district. This is Eby's Landing on Whidbey Island. I don't know if any of you have been there. It's a landscape preserve. Another thing that's been lost in the suburbanization movement is farmland or agricultural areas. This was a fairly early attempt to document key features of a historic agricultural landscape and then work on a consensus basis with all the people who live in that area to figure out a way to manage that so that it retains its historic character. And I think with that, we're just about done. Just to recap, some of the things that can be done to make historic preservation happen are commemoration, and that's the marker programs and so forth, just to let people know that something happened. Acquisition, which was a very early mechanism. You buy the place, you turn it into a museum. Very costly. You can't do very many of those, but it is a mechanism for preservation. Documentation, you looked at that Historic American Building Survey artwork from the 30s. The place may be gone, but if you have a good record of it, somebody else can learn something from that place even after it's gone. Regulation, this is always the sore point, that those historic districts that have design review, the constraints that are put on federal agencies as they carry out their work, is a way that preservation can be made to happen. But the best one is stewardship. That's the approach that I think Holden is trying to take. We're working on a preservation plan here. How can you accommodate current and future uses and still maintain the character of this place by being good stewards of the place, taking care of it, doing your work in appropriate ways, with the idea that you're here for a short time and the place may be here for a long time. And with that, it's time for discussion or more coffee.
I hope you know to stop in Milwaukee Railroad Station because that's where my wife's father worked.
Oh, good. probably looked quite a bit different when he was working there.
That's a lot. They preserved the look pretty well.
Is there a plan in anyone's mind about special historic recognition for Holden and somewhere?
I probably should have prefaced everything with that. About 10 years ago, Holden was determined eligible for the National Register. We're going to talk about that a little bit more as the week goes on, but if you remember Nixon jumping there, that determination of eligibility conferred some protection on Holden. But also, because Holden has a special use permit from the Forest Service, it also gave Holden some new responsibilities as far as how it maintains the buildings. So there's a little tension there that has to be worked out. I mean, this is a place that for years had a pretty free rein about how work was done. And now the Forest Service and the State Preservation Office are watching just to make sure that the place retains its character.
Big Brother is here as well.
Well, it's Big Brother, but also remember that Holden exists, you know, we got it for a buck. It exists in a state of grace. It's on Forest Service land. And so Holden is incorporating that stewardship model for the built setting here into its general stewardship plan. It's pretty natural progression here.
I did an elder hostel service program in Little Falls, Montana. Minnesota.
Oh, great.
The Weyerhaeuser House.
Oh, I know that place.
And that sort of, I think we were the first elder hostel group to be there. And it sort of gives you a microcosm of all of the conflicts and problems between local communities and citizens, and you feel they have the stewardship of that, and outsiders coming in. It was an amazing week.
But Little Falls is a really good example of a town that has taken the historic character of its downtown and really made something out of it. You go to that town, and it's still a going downtown. Mm-hmm. There's still stuff down there.
Yeah.
And the historic buildings have been a piece of that.
Mm-hmm.
There's a real interesting case in the Seattle area where several of the older churches were on the historic register. And one of the churches, First Covenant Church, felt that their church was very old. All these churches were built in the early part of the century. They felt that in order for them to use their church funds to preserve the building interfered with their use of their funds for the mission of the church. Mm-hmm. They felt that was the overriding reason for having the church. So they filed suits, and it went to the state Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court held that they did have the right to use their funds for the mission of the church rather than to preserve the building.
This is a very active, I'm sorry I interrupted you.
Well, what I was going to say, they have preserved their church, but they've also solved that problem, and I know my church was one of those that was considered a historic building, so it always was a problem when you've got a roof that leaks and everything else. So actually, it was referred to the United States Supreme Court, that case was, and the Supreme Court didn't take the case, but they sent it back to the Washington State Supreme Court and asked them to review it. In other words, they didn't seem to like their decision, but they kept that decision, so it held.
That is a very active issue, I guess, within historic preservation. Partly because the way the National Register is written, and we'll talk about this a little bit tomorrow, certain types of properties are exempted, and churches are one of those, and it's to maintain that church-state division. Yeah. And so when it's designated for architectural significance or something like that, there's some tension there because they're not eligible for grants, they can't take tax credits, but yet there's a burden put on them to maintain the property. And in many cases, it's just pure finances, too. I mean, Holden faces that. You've got 24 buildings with huge roofs here, and to replace all of them with X kind of materials is X amount of money, and Y kind of materials is X plus 100 kind type, amount of money. So it's an economic issue, financial issue, and all those things have to be balanced out. So it's not always, a purist. You're not always able to follow a pure line to get to the objective.
Marion, what church in Seattle?
Pardon?
What church is yours?
Oh, the First Church of Christ Scientists. And it was built in 1914. The materials were shipped around the Horn from New England.
Wow.
And it has beautiful Tiffany-type stained glass windows. It's a gorgeous building. Very large. It seats 900 people.
Where is it?
It's on Capitol Hill in Seattle. And it's a real glory to maintain that building.
We'll look at on Wednesday, I think, we'll look at a very small prairie Christian Science Church in Minnesota that was about as far gone as any building I've seen that's been nicely restored. But it's, I think you'll be interested in that. It's a fabulous building. Well, you're awful quiet. Must mean you need more coffee.
Very interesting.
We had just near us, we lived in the country north of Rochester, and the county is going to replace this old iron bridge because it was not stable. Mm-hmm. One fellow lived fairly near the bridge. Didn't like to have a new bridge there. He thought that'd be too big and too noticeable. So he went around and got a lot of neighbors who didn't know what he was doing to sign the partition, and it was named the National Historical Site, or whatever you do. And so now the county can't touch it without going through a lot of...
But what they'll probably do is go out and take pictures of it.
Well, what the county did is
says,
what the county did is says that's too much monkey business. They shut down the bridge and so you can't drive there anymore.
Well, that's too bad.
And that was 25 years ago, and it's still shut down. And farmers who had land on both sides of that bridge were
not happy.
Modestly stated, not real happy about it.
That sounds like a federal solution.
And it's an old iron bridge of which I've seen many.
But that's exactly this process that at work. So it doesn't always make people happy.
No.
Bridge
is still closed.
That if the Forest Service wanted to make a fuss up here and get rid of Holden Village, that God would get rid of the Forest Service.
I don't think the Forest Service wants to get rid of Holden Village at all. The Forest Service is
I think that they should be happy.
Yeah, I think it's been
taking
a really
care of it and so
forth. Well, and I would think they would want the best roofs. For instance, if there was a fire here, don't put a cedar roof on those buildings.
We're gonna
put
talk
something
about that.
That's not going to burn.
This is also a very hot, it's part of why I'm here. I'm here to teach this, but also to work with the operations folks here to work out some of those issues. And they are tough because there's snow loads, there's money, there's fire danger.
Has there ever been a fire around
if you
close?
Go up Chalet Hill, there's a gap tooth there where the second house should be, and you'll see the foundation. That burned in 68, I think. And then there was an earlier garage up on the tailings that went up in spectacular fashion 20 years ago or so as well. So there have been a few.
Yes,
and lots of little chimney fires and that sort of thing.
That would be a concern.
And that's what preservation is.
It's right in here.
It requires flexibility and consensus building. Otherwise, it just doesn't work.
Well, thinking of the bridge situation, what I'm going to think of is expensive, but the bridge couldn't hold vehicles, I would think. Is there any way that they could take the bridge, move the bridge for a footbridge, and put in the reliable whatever bridge they would put in? But I know it's costly, but...
That has happened. I mean, and what that generally requires, a lot of times a rails-to-trails situation, something like that, they'll need a bridge and they can get one and it's strong enough to carry bicycles but not strong enough to carry cars. Often one thing that the county will do is offer the bridge for sale for a dollar, and surprisingly some of them have been sold. But documentation is generally the solution, and generally it means taking, you know, 10 good quality photographs of it and storing them at the Historical Society. So I'm surprised that's an unusual circumstance.
Yeah.
Well, I'm happy to visit if people want to visit. Otherwise, you've got some free time till 10:30. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
That's going to be songs.
Very interesting.
Well, before you get away,
back to CS.
It is often really controversial.
In Seattle, the First Methodist Church down
Seattle. Yeah, no, I was worried about that one.
Yes.
Was
what? They are doing something with that because our women donated some.